hears the clock. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Reader's Digest. Keeper of the Flame. His best friend died a hero's death in Vietnam. Six decades later, he won't let us forget. By Tom Halliman, Jr. It's late in the evening, and David Nelson finds himself in a familiar spot, at a desk in his home in Houston, typing yet another letter to yet another publication about an old friend, Lee Roy Heron, who died in some godforsaken piece of jungle in Vietnam. It had not gone well the last time the two men spoke. For decades after that, Nelson had not thought much about the man he'd once called his best friend. He'd been angry with Leroy, believing that his death was foolish, as he should never have been in combat. But now, at age 80, and armed with new facts, Nelson has been on a mission to clear his conscience and set the record straight about Leroy Heron's last minutes. For the past 25 years, he has written and sent more than 2,000 letters, emails, story pitches, and follow-ups, enough words to fill several novels, to reporters and editors at various newspapers and magazines, including this one. Obsession is a good word, admits Nelson. He knows his wife thinks he's gone overboard about a man who died 56 years ago. I wouldn't say she's jealous, he said. She just doesn't want me spending a whole lot of time writing letters. She wants me to watch a TV program with her. Nelson struggles to find the words to explain the meaning behind this long odyssey of his. It's easier for him to explain the nuances of a legal brief than to explore the depths of his soul. I don't know, he finally says. I've never been able to piece it all together. Perhaps it's because Nelson fails to recognize that this is not only Heron's story, it's his too. David Nelson and Leroy Heron met in grade school and were known around school as friendly competitors, each pushing the other to do better. In the eighth grade, Nelson won the school spelling bee and went to the national competition. Heron came in second. Both were invited into the National Junior Honor Society. Heron won a citizenship award. Nelson was the runner-up. On the high school football team, Nelson held down left end, Heron left guard. They bonded while walking to and from school. They lived a half mile apart, and Nelson would pick Heron up along the way and drop him off on the return, which gave them time to talk about life. At that age, that meant school, music, movies, and, of course, girls. With each step, they came to understand and trust each other, knowing they'd always have the other's back. Both enrolled at Texas Tech University in Lubbock and were admitted to Phi Eta Sigma, a National Freshman Honor Society. In 1964, with the Vietnam War raging, Heron enlisted in the Marine Corps and was sent to a six-week officer candidate school. He convinced Nelson to enlist, and then Nelson, too, completed an officer candidate program. They each agreed to a three-year commitment that would start when they graduated. They were excited. Imagine, they'd say to each other, two West Texas friends serving alongside each other as combat infantry officers. But in the spring of 1967, Nelson changed his mind. He wasn't so much afraid for himself, he says, but he feared that he might make a mistake in judgment on the battlefield that would get the men served under him killed. He transferred into a new Marine program that would extend his deferment if he went to law school. There he would study to become a Marine Corps lawyer, specializing in criminal cases and court-martials. Now came the hard part, breaking the news to Heron. He chose to do so the night of a mutual friend's wedding. After the ceremony, the two sat in Heron's parked car, pondering what the future held in store for them, which included the basic school, where new Marine officers are trained. There, the two newly commissioned officers would learn the duties, responsibilities, and skills required of a rifle platoon commander. There was a pause. Then Nelson told Heron he would not be going into combat with him. He was going to law school instead. Even in the dark car, Nelson saw a frown on Heron's face. He waited for an argument, maybe a request to reconsider, perhaps even a good word. Silence. And then, just one word from Heron. Okay. Nelson got out. Never again did they have a meaningful conversation. 2 years after closing the car door on Heron, Nelson returned to his childhood home in West Texas to spend Easter Sunday with his new wife and his parents. He had moved on, and he expected this to be a nice break from the rigors of law school at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. The last he'd heard about Heron, his old friend had been selected for advanced training at the Defense Language Institute Foreign Language Center in Monterey, California, learning Vietnamese. Nelson took comfort knowing that he and Heron would likely work out of offices far from the battlefield. He'd be surrounded by documents in an office. Heron would be stationed at the Pentagon or at an overseas base analyzing communiques and messages while trying to figure out enemy strategy. After a leisurely Easter lunch, Nelson asked his parents if they'd heard from Leroy Heron. His mother paused. She looked away and then, in a quavering voice, said she'd recently read in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal that Heron had died in Vietnam. Nelson felt sick. His heart raced. He struggled to catch his breath. His stomach screwed up in knots. "What happened?" he asked. She said she knew nothing more. Nelson, a man who doesn't cry, gathered his composure and excused himself. He went to another room and called a high school buddy. He told the man on the other end of the line what his mother had just told him. "It's true," his friend said. "How in the hell did it happen? I thought he was going to be a translator at some base." "He volunteered to go to Vietnam. I don't know why or how, just that he charged the enemy and got himself shot." Nelson hung up the phone. What a damn fool. What was he doing in Vietnam? Why was he on the battlefield? He remembered that in high school football game, Heron had broken his arm and refused to leave until the coach ordered him off the field into the hospital. Had that same youthful gung-ho attitude led to his death? A fool. A damn fool. A couple of decades later, in 1990, 16 years after having fulfilled his 3-year commitment practicing military law, Nelson found himself in Washington, D.C. Now a certified public accountant and a partner in an international accounting firm, he was attending a tax seminar. Though the war had not been top of mind for some time, he decided to visit the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. He found what looked like a thick telephone book, all plastic pages, that listed the more than 58,000 names on the wall. He flipped through the pages until he got to the H's and found Leroy Heron's name and his location on the wall. He began the long walk down a slope, which took him to the heart of the dead. He had always thought the memorial was just a wall of names of those who'd paid the ultimate sacrifice for what Nelson had come to believe was a fruitless war. Now, standing before the long list of names, he searched for his friends. There it was on panel 32W, line 78, etched in black granite. He touched it. An official guide explained how Nelson could take a rubbing of Heron's name by putting a sheet of paper over the recessed lettering and rubbing it with a piece of charcoal. Nelson did so. Then the man who didn't cry cried. Nelson, at the top of his profession, was married and had 2 daughters. What did Leroy have to show for his life? Nothing. What a senseless death. Yes, a fool. Nelson's opinion of Herron took a dramatic turn in the summer of 1997 when he heard retired Marine Colonel Wesley Fox, an old instructor of his, speak before the Texas Association of Former Marines. The topic? The Medal of Honor that Fox had been awarded in Vietnam. Fox set the stage, telling the audience he had been wounded twice in a brutal ambush on February 22, 1969. He was the only officer still capable of organizing the defense. The others had been killed in action or severely wounded. "I want you to understand it's never one person that accomplishes everything," Fox began. "Sometimes you may think that a John Wayne type of person does it all and wins the whole battle, but it's always a combination of people. In my case, two outstanding lieutenants were key to that victory that day. One was a stout young man from West Texas named Lee Herron." Nelson gasped at the mention of his friend. At the end of Fox's talk, he hung back until only he and Fox remained. He reintroduced himself to his former instructor and said he'd gone to school with Herron. "You were a friend of Lee Heron's?" "Well, he was a great guy, you know. He always wanted to be with the men. He'd tell me to get some rest while he scouted the line, made sure the men were dug in properly and not asleep in their foxholes," said Fox. Nelson asked how Herron had died. The two men found seats in the empty room. Then Fox took Nelson back to February 22, 1969. He began with facts and numbers. A Marine company made up of three platoons, 20 or so members in each group, emerged from the jungle to fill their canteens at a watering hole surrounded by trees. For a moment, they could relax. And then, Fox told Nelson, all hell broke loose. Mortars, grenades, and machine gun fire rained down on the company from three bunkers hidden on a hill. It was a well-planned ambush, the enemy waiting patiently, knowing the soldiers had to drink. Fox, in charge of the company, quickly deployed his men. There was no cover, no place to hide, as the trees offered little protection. The plan, made on the fly, was for the platoons to somehow encircle the bunkers and kill the enemy before getting slaughtered. The first platoon leader was shot and severely wounded, but a Marine armed with a bazooka crawled through the jungle, fired, and destroyed one bunker and the men inside. Then the third platoon leader was shot and killed. Fox and his men huddled to come up with a new plan with the leader of the second platoon. A mortar landed in their midst, the shrapnel wounding Fox and others, and severely wounding the second platoon leader. Only one officer among those standing with Fox was left unscathed, Herron. "I had a simple message for Lee. Take over the second platoon," Fox said. "The men in the first and third platoons were pinned down. I told Lee it was up to him. He immediately said okay, and led the second platoon up the hill. But they were quickly pinned down. I didn't have much hope that Lee Herron could make a difference." The one thing Herron had going for him was the thick mist that shrouded them. He and his radio man took advantage of the cover, crawling through the jungle to reach the second bunker. It was a fool's mission. Herron had no bazooka or heavy artillery. He carried with him his rifle and the hand grenade strapped across his chest. Herron got about 90 yards away from the bunker, almost the length of a football field. Bullets would be useless against the bunker, Fox had said. Herron's only hope was to throw a grenade through a small opening in the bunker where the enemy fired rounds as if in a shooting gallery. In the best of situations during training, it would be difficult. Here, death almost certain. Herron had to throw the grenade with the skill and accuracy of a pitcher in the seventh game of the World Series. While listening to Fox, Nelson remembered when he and Leroy had competed in a high school competition to see who could throw a softball the farthest. Nelson threw the ball 85 yards. "Top that," he said. Then Herron took the ball and heaved it 90 yards. Among the death and carnage, almost 9,000 miles from Lubbock, Herron threw a grenade. Bullseye. Then another. Bullseye. Only one bunker remained. Herron, down to just a few grenades, set out once more with his radio man. Suddenly the sun came out and the mist, their cover, dissipated. The enemy took aim and fired. The radio man, shot in the midsection of his body, survived, but was paralyzed. Herron, shot in the chest, died immediately. Stunned, Nelson listened as Fox told him that he had managed to call in air support to bomb the third bunker since the clouds had lifted. The remaining bunker was destroyed, and the battle ended. 11 men died, and 58 were wounded. Without Lee, it would have been worse. The company would have been wiped out. For his actions, Leroy Herron was awarded the Navy Cross for extraordinary heroism in combat. On the way home that night, Nelson had but one thought. My friend was not a fool. Nelson remained mystified how Herron, who should have been in an office far from the war, had ended up on the battlefield. And so he began his research. He learned that in December of 1968, Herron had checked in at the headquarters and service company of the 9th Marine Regiment located in Vietnam at the Vandergrift Combat Base, where he was to translate Vietnamese documents. Almost immediately, he pestered his commanding officer to send him to the front lines. Reluctantly, the CO assigned Herron as executive officer of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marine Regiment. 2 months later, Herron died saving the lives of many Marines who went on to live full lives after the war. Nelson reached out to some of those Marines. Here's what one said. When Alpha Company was ambushed, it was Lee who made the sacrifice and took over my platoon after I was wounded. Lee was brave as he was righteous, moral and gentle. One thing I can say about Lee Herron, when I was around him, I was the man I wanted to be, not the man I knew I was. Another told Nelson, Lee came up to me after the mortar hit in our midst. I was lying on my back on top of another wounded Marine. Lee knelt down and asked me, having to scream above the roar of the firefight, where my battle dressing was, seeing that I was bleeding. Then he used the only four-letter word I had ever heard him say, damn. He was upset by the carnage, but had that look of determination and firm resolve to do his duty. He patted my head and moved off toward the dug-in enemy. Leroy Herron was a rarity, a bona fide hero. But why is David Nelson, a man entering his ninth decade, inundating publications with letters, emails, and story pitches about a man who died so long ago? To some small degree, by trying to get strangers to learn the story of Leroy Herron, he has made amends for that night in the car 58 years earlier. And to him, the obsession, all the thousands of letters that kept him from watching TV with his wife, is a blessing. It keeps Leroy alive in my heart, said Nelson, the man who believes he's more comfortable with facts than feelings. Then after a pause, I have dreams. Leroy is alive. Somehow, he didn't die over there. That was Keeper of the Flame, by Tom Hallman, Jr. How Nature Heals. Getting outdoors is as close to a cure-all as you'll find. It's fast and free, with few, if any, side effects. By Charlotte Hilton Anderson. Early 2023 was a tough time for Taylor McMahon. The 21-year-old college student says she was struggling with some intense anxiety and depression, which led to physical issues as well. So McMahon decided to seek help from a doctor. The diagnosis she received, chronic anxiety, wasn't much of a surprise. But the treatment her doctor prescribed was. She literally told me to go touch grass, McMahon recalls. quoting a popular internet meme meant to poke gentle fun at people so caught up in their online world that they forget the real world exists. McMahon laughed, but her doctor was being serious. She told me the next time I was obsessing over a worry to stop what I was doing, go outside, take my shoes off, and put my feet in the grass. She said it would be therapeutic. McMahon was skeptical at first, but she decided to follow her doctor's advice and was surprised to discover how well and quickly it worked. Simply being outdoors short-circuited her anxiety. "I immediately felt more calm and relaxed," McMahon says. So when one of her professors suggested she enroll in a summer course called Nature Immersion and Human Well-Being, she jumped at the opportunity. For 1 week at Colorado University's mountain campus, she experienced all kinds of healing through activities in nature, from hiking to swimming to climbing trees to sitting around the campfire. "I learned not just that nature works as a cure for mental and physical problems, but how and why it works," she said. "That week was life-changing. It felt magical." McMahon's experience aligns with a growing trend in medicine, doctors prescribing time in nature to their patients to address a wide variety of physical and mental health concerns. These nature prescriptions aren't just feel-good recommendations. They're evidence-based interventions backed by science, and they're becoming increasingly popular for just the reason McMahon said. They work. Scott Kaiser, MD, a board-certified geriatrician and director of geriatric cognitive health at the Pacific Neuroscience Institute, is one of these doctors. He says he frequently uses nature prescriptions to help his patients mentally and physically. "Nature has a profound impact on healthy aging and overall well-being," he explains. "There are several factors in healthy aging: diet, exercise, mindfulness, community, creativity, and a sense of purpose. And being outdoors can provide access to all of these, often at the same time. I can't overstate how powerful nature can be as a healer." Bert Mandelbaum, MD, a sports medicine specialist and orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Curl and Job Institute in Santa Monica, California, also prescribes time in nature to his patients. "Getting outside takes us back to how we were designed to work. It's like a reset for our bodies," he says. "I tell my patients that being outdoors has nose-to-toes benefits." How to fill a nature prescription. Nature prescriptions aren't necessarily about getting exercise or pumping your heart, although they can do that too. "They're more about mindfulness and soaking in the outdoors," Dr. Mandelbaum says. Dr. Kaiser agrees. Nature treats the whole person, not just symptoms. Here are some common ways that Dr. Kaiser, Dr. Mandelbaum, and other doctors in a variety of fields are using the great outdoors to improve their patients' health. Sensory walks are an easy way to get started. Dr. Kaiser advises walking mindfully through nature while focusing on all five senses, paying attention to what you can see, smell, hear, touch, and even taste. "Leave your gadgets at home," he adds, "so you can be undistracted and really experience it all." To take it to the next level, head to a nature preserve, forest, botanical garden, mountain, or lake, and engage in forest bathing. This Japanese practice, known as Shinrin-yoku, means immersing yourself in a forest environment, not with a goal like hiking to a destination, but simply to exist in nature and soak it in as you would a warm bath. Another prescription gaining popularity is cold therapy, exposing yourself to cold water or air. Some swear by this, although actual research is mixed. If you want to give it a try, one way to do this is a cold plunge. Submerge yourself in a body of water that feels uncomfortably cold, the discomfort is the point, and stay there for 30 seconds to a minute. Most people start with water that's about 50 to 60 degrees, though some go colder as their tolerance increases. If that sounds too intense, you could try simply walking for 15 minutes in the early morning. Sunlight on your skin stimulates vitamin D production, which is really essential for many aspects of health and well-being, Dr. Kaiser says. And getting early morning sunlight in your eyes will help sync your circadian cycle. However, if you're on a medication or have a medical condition that makes you more sensitive to sunlight, talk to your doctor first. Other simple prescriptions include gardening, hiking, biking, swimming, or picnicking. The options are almost limitless. And if active pursuits feel too much, even sitting outdoors on your patio or on a park bench will bring benefits, our docs say. Dr. Kaiser and Dr. Mandelbaum emphasize that nature prescriptions are adaptable. It's about finding what works for each person. For instance, I once used whale watching as a prescription for one patient because they loved being on the ocean, says Dr. Kaiser. Yours might be watching the sunset from your backyard. Mine is sitting on the beach or riding waves. How long do you need to do it? Even small doses of nature can make a big difference, Dr. Kaiser says. This doesn't need to be an escape to Walden Pond for 2 years. Simply sitting under a tree for 5 minutes will reduce stress and improve your mood. That said, try to get 30 minutes to an hour of nature exposure at least 2 or 3 times a week, he recommends. You can combine this with exercise like walking or biking, as these healthy habits build on each other. But you don't have to. You'll still see the benefits, even if your heart rate doesn't soar. For McMahon, 15 minutes is her sweet spot. She goes outside every day, rain or shine, and has a longer outdoor experience of several hours once or twice a month. My favorite nature prescription is to just lie down under a tree and stare up at the leaves and sky, McMahon says. I learned in my class that just being around trees improves my immune system, lowers my risk of cancer, and increases my creativity, focus, and problem solving. All things I definitely need as a college student. New evidence it works. The idea of nature as medicine isn't new. Ancient practices like Ayurvedic Ritucharya, or seasonal syncing, the practice of altering your diet, activity, and sleep cycles according to the season of the year, Japanese Shinrin Yoku, and traditional Chinese medicine have long touted the benefits of connecting with nature. But Western medicine is now catching up thanks to a growing body of research. A 2023 systematic review and meta-analysis published in The Lancet looked at 92 separate studies of nature prescription programs. The findings were impressive. Nature prescriptions can lower both systolic and diastolic blood pressure, inflammation, and risk of cardiovascular disease. They can also aid weight loss, lessen chronic pain, and improve mobility. On the mental health side, nature prescriptions can lower stress, depression, and anxiety while improving cognitive function. And these are just a few of the health benefits the researchers found. On a personal level, I saw this in action with a patient of mine who was in her 80s with Alzheimer's, Dr. Kaiser says. Her family was at their wit's end because she was constantly agitated, upset, and unhappy, despite having all her needs cared for. I added a prescription for daily nature walks, and the difference was absolutely incredible. She became more engaged, had improved function, and, most importantly, was much happier. That daily walk became the most important medicine she took. Dr. Mandelbaum adds that his patients who take his nature prescriptions to heart seem to recover from surgery better. The science is clear, Dr. Kaiser says. Nature isn't just a luxury. It's a necessity for good health. Veronica Ivy, a 43-year-old former professional cyclist, would agree. In 2017, at the peak of her career, she found herself subtly struggling to make it through training rides. She was exhausted, far more than she would expect to be from her usual training.